Greatest sin in America. Turn to the 22nd chapter of Ezekiel. It begins in verse 1, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Now thou son of man, wilt thou judge the bloody city? Yea, thou shalt show her all her abominations." And he's talking to the city of Jerusalem, as we'll see from the context here, and of course, as you can see from the other chapters just before that. Now, sometimes when we read the prophets, it sounds like a broken record. Sometimes they say, well, Pastor Emery sounds that way too, because whenever he reads them, there is one message. Israel, you are disobeying God's laws. Israel, turn and obey God's laws. That's the message of the prophets from beginning to end. Turn to the 58th chapter of Isaiah, where he was told, "Cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sin." And this was the call of Isaiah, lift up his voice like a trumpet. Now, if you're just speaking, people may not pay much attention, but if you blow a trumpet, they're going to turn and listen. The point was to get these people to listen. Turn to the first chapter of Jeremiah, where Jeremiah was called to go to the Israel people, and God told him, among other things, in verse 16, "And I will utter my judgments against them touching all their wickedness, who have forsaken me, and have burned incense unto other gods, and worshipped the works of their own hands." So the message from Jeremiah was more or less the same thing. Israel, you have sinned, you are sinning. Israel, turn and obey me. And of course he added, things that God would do because of the sins of Israel. All right, let's go back to Ezekiel 22. In verse 3 he said, "Then say thou, thus saith the Lord God, the city sheddeth blood in the midst of it, that her time may come, and maketh idols against herself to defile herself." Rather strange way of putting this, that phrase, "that her time may come," the implication being that God is allowing this so that something will come to an end, some time will come, or something will take place in relation to what they are doing. And he says, "and maketh idols against herself to defile herself." Now sometimes we think, well, when Israel is worshiping false gods and is turning away and making idols, that they are doing this against God, when it is more nearly true that they are doing it against themselves. Israel's worship of idols does not injure God, but it does injure Israel. Like our sinning, we often use the term, and it's a correct term, that when we sin, we're breaking God's laws. Well, we don't change the law. Actually, what happens is the law breaks us, and the law breaks Israel. The law stands. Do not injure the law when we violate it, but the violation brings injury upon us. So when God says, "They maketh idols against herself to defile herself," Israel is defiled with these false religions. Verse 4, "Thou art become guilty in thy blood that thou hast shed, and hast defiled thyself in thine idols, which thou hast made. Thou hast caused thy days to draw near." Here's another phrase indicating something was going to come to an end because of what they were doing. "And art come even unto thy years. Therefore have I made thee a reproach unto the heathen, and a mocking to all countries." Israel had become so filthy that God had said he would make her a mockery among the other nations. In other words, the heathen would look at Israel and look down at Israel as being worse than they were. You probably noticed in recent times in the news media, the so-called Islamic government of Iran is now going to put in effect the laws of Islam, which require punishment for thieves and punishment for murders and so on. And our liberal news media are just horrified. In fact, there was an editorial in the paper the other day calling for the end of the killings in Iran. Well, now, the communists have killed 3 million people in Southeast Asia, not for violation or crimes against other people, but in order to establish their communist rule. And I see little or nothing in the news media about that. So when someone decides to use corporal punishment on crimes which are violations of God's law, they all throw up their hands horror. Now, I'm inclined to think that the backing of that revolution in Iran is primarily communistic, and perhaps some of this religious laws are being put into effect as a cover. But it's interesting to note that our news media and the people in responsibility are horrified at judgments for crime. Don't mind people being killed by the millions who are innocent, but brother, if you want to put to death some man who's committed murder, they just are frightened to death that the nation would move toward obedience to God's laws. Verse 5, those that be near and those that be far from thee shall mock thee, which are infamous and much vexed. In other words, they'll look down on Israel. Behold, the princes of Israel, every one were in thee to their power to shed blood. Now, it's probably true today that the rulers of America, rulers of Britain, are really more responsible for the shedding of blood around the world than you might say the so-called communists are. Because after all, who finances most of the wars? Who provides the military armament for the fighting between the black nations or the black and white nations of Africa? Who allowed or set up the situation where the communists could kill 2 to 3 million people in Indochina after we pulled out? We did. Of course, if you'll do enough investigating, you'll discover that the so-called communist or Bolshevik revolution in Russia was financed out of the United States to begin with. Gold and the men who went there to overthrow the Tsar's government came from New York City. So you can blame our nation and our people for allowing this. We are, through our rulers, guilty of blood shed all over the world. Hold the princes of Israel, every one were in thee for their power to shed blood. In thee have they set life by father and mother. Midst of thee have they dealt by oppression with the stranger. In thee have they vexed the fatherless and the widow. Now that must have been true in ancient Israel because Ezekiel was speaking to them. But it is true in America today that we set life by father and mother. In fact, our whole educational system is becoming an indoctrination thing to set the children against the parents. If you don't believe that, I would suggest some of you get a copy of that book we have titled The Hate Factory. And it's about the social science classes in our schools. And some of you young people who've recently gone through social studies, they call it, in the classrooms will realize by reading the book how they set you against everything that America formerly stood for. Make your parents seem to be old-fashioned. Everything that you did was puritanic and too strict and so on and so on. And by the time our children go through grade school and high school, they come out hostile to our society, hostile to our religion, hostile to their parents. And this must have been going on in ancient Israel, because he said, in thee have they set life by father and mother. This is done, of course, in America to some extent by our rulers. The fatherless and the widow are being robbed in 1,000 different ways, and perhaps the worst is yet to come. If we ever obtain absolute equality under the law, many widows will not draw Social Security from their husband's earnings. If they've never worked and been dependent upon a husband, they will not have anything coming under Social Security. The deflation of the value of money and savings is perhaps the worst kind, robbing them of their wealth and security. It takes the very bread from their mouths. And in fact, the higher taxation on real estate, on homes, which is forbidden in God's law, is forcing widows and orphans to move from their homes into smaller living quarters or in with relatives after the husband and the father passes away. All of this, of course, is done in violation of God's law and is robbing the fatherless and the widow. Ancient Israel must not have been taking care of the widow and the orphan either, as God indicates here. Verse 8, Thou hast despised mine holy things, and hast profaned my Sabbath. Now this goes much further than just the profaning of what we call the Sunday, or the one day out of seven. We've had opportunity to talk in recent months, as you know, to many farmers when we were in Washington, D.C. Every once in a while, we'll take the opportunity to tell them that their problem is not all money, their problem is violation of God's laws. And we mentioned to them that God has a Sabbath of the land. We asked them if they'd ever heard about it. Well, I don't recall more than one or two ever saying, well, yes, they'd heard that the land was to lie fallow every seventh year. It was not to be cultivated except for 6 years and then lie fallow. It was called a Sabbath. Now, we profane that because we do not allow the land to lie fallow, and yet almost any person we've ever talked to who has something to do with agriculture will admit that if we were to do that, that would break the life cycle of these insect pests that are eating their crops. Then they wouldn't have to pour on the land all of this poison in order to kill the bugs, and then they poison us in the process. Seventh year Sabbath would literally end pesticide use in America, I believe. And of course, God's word says it would be, we would be blessed for it, and he's accusing Israel of not doing that. In a newspaper article some time ago, I read how the Jews in Palestine keep that seventh year Sabbath. And of course, it apparently is rather typical. They do follow that. Where they have the land, they do farm it for 6 years. Then they rent it to an Arab for the seventh year and let him farm it. So meanwhile, they have kept the letter of the law, you see, but they still get income from the land, and the land does not lie fallow. So it's still a violation in spite of the facade of obedience. In America, we do not even have the facade. Thou hast despised mine holy things, and hast profaned my Sabbath. In thee are men that carry tails to shed blood, and in thee they eat upon the mountains, and in the midst of thee they commit lewdness. Now that eating upon the mountains has a reference, of course, to heathen religions, because Baal worship and the worship of idols was always done on hills, or on mountains, which is what he's saying. You're worshiping false gods. Thee have they discovered their father's nakedness, and thee have they humbled her that was set apart for pollution. One hath committed abomination with his neighbor's wife, and another hath lewdly defiled his daughter-in-law, and another in thee hath humbled his sister, his father's daughter. So these are charges of sexual sins or violation of God's laws in relation to marriage, corrupted and sinful practices. And we recognize that these are happening in America also, as they must have been in ancient Israel in Ezekiel's time. And then he ends this section of listing their sins. In other words, he's listing all the things they are doing in violation of God's laws, and later he's going to tell them what is going to happen because of it. But notice, as he ends this, verse 12, in thee have they taken gifts to shed blood. Bribery is becoming a common way of life in American politics. You can list many ways. From bribery of top officials in the government for armaments for other nations to make war, bribery of judges to release criminals who then kill or injure other citizens, bribery to approve dangerous medicines and drugs, which kill and injure citizens, even such things as national vaccination or inoculation plans, which injure the citizens, to fatten the pockets of the so-called medical profession and possibly even the politicians. Now, we see this, and the news media to some extent is revealing this. They're letting us know that there are certain congressmen and representatives and mayors and district attorneys and attorney generals and so on who are accepting bribery. But you know, by and large, the news media does not tell us that where the nations have what they call communism, the government is operated by bribery. In fact, another term for communism could be a government by bribery. If you don't believe me, if you ever have an opportunity to talk to someone who has lived in a communist country, ask them about that. And they will tell you that every official at every level gets paid by the people below him to do what he supposedly is supposed to do. Some people have gotten out of communist countries after they had worked for communism, in other words, to help the communists take over their country. Then they left and were absolutely appalled because they thought communism was going to end this corruption. Instead, it organized it. It put it on an operating plane. And you can't get a job, you can't get a promotion, you can't move up, you can't get an education, you can't get an apartment in a communist country unless you bribe the official in charge of whatever that is. Now, this is not stopped by the government, because the government is a government of criminals, and this is the system. Now, we are seeing that thing come to pass in America, where people can bribe officials in order to get justice or to prevent justice in the land. God was accusing these ancient Israelites of doing that. See, have they taken gifts to shed blood? Many of these things, of course, lead to injury or death among the people. Thou hast taken usury and increase, and thou hast greedily gained of thy neighbors by extortion, and hast forgotten me, saith the Lord God. I think it is significant that the last thing, the last sin or iniquity in Israel listed here is, thou hast taken usury and increase, and thou hast greedily gained of thy neighbors by extortion. You've noticed here, perhaps, as we read this, in verses 6 through 11, as he's listing the other things, in most cases, in thee are they that do such and so. In other words, in your land are some people who do such and so. But then when you get down to this last verse, it's changed to the personal pronoun, thou, you have taken usury and increase, and you have gained of thy neighbors by extortion. I think this is an accusation against the whole people of Israel. All of them were involved in taking extortion from their neighbors. Now, if you think you're not involved in that, let's go back to the law and find out why God accuses the whole nation of this sin, whereas the other things, it seems to be that only a portion of them are involved in. Turn back to Leviticus 25, and we'll read verses 35 through 37. And if thy brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him. In other words, you'll do something to alleviate his problem. Yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with thee. Take thou no usury of him or increase, but fear thy God, that thy brother may live with thee. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals for increase. Now, whenever we talk to men in the congressional offices, and I'm using this as an example, because these are the men who write the laws for the nation. And whenever we mention that God's law forbids interest, some will indicate they didn't know that, but almost without exception, the rest of them, and this is the majority, who admit they did know God's law forbade interest or usury on money, they will say, but who would lend money if they didn't get interest? And then they stand there and look at us, and the implication is, well, if you didn't have interest on money, no one would lend any money, so the poor people would, of course, all be without money when they needed it. Well, the question is a valid one, because I'll just repeat it right here. Who among you would lend money if you didn't get interest on it? The only people who would lend money without interest are what people? The people who will obey God Almighty. Follow me? Almost no one in America will obey God if it means they can't take increase on their loan. This involves every individual, not just organization. Now notice this command about usury begins in verse 35 with this. If thy brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him. It is a command, you shall lend him money. whatever he needs if he's poor and he needs it. Now, this is no command to lend money to someone who wants to buy a better car or who wants to go in business. Think perhaps if he had a new machine, he'd do better on the job. No, this is the lending of money or victuals or whatever to help a person who is in need of the physical things to sustain a life. In fact, you can go through the Bible from one end to the other, and you will find no command to lend anything other than to poor people who need it to stay alive. But the command is, lend it to them, or to give it to them, as the case may be. And then, when you make that point, once you make the point that they are to lend the money, then they always have this question. Well, what if he can't pay? You see, because even if you convince them that they should lend without interest or increase, you have to convince them again to lend it with the possibility they might not get it back. And so then you ask, who among you would lend money to someone who might not be able to repay? Well, God answers that also. Turn to Deuteronomy 15. We'll begin in verse 1. And at the end of every 7 years thou shalt make a release. This is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lendeth aught unto his neighbor shall release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbor or of his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. The loan is collectible any time during this 7 year period. But if the 7 year period, and this is not 7 years from the time you make the loan, this is a 7 year cycle that is a national cycle. And the loan is collectible and payable any time during that 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, if the individual cannot pay it, you cancel it. Well, in fact, that's not absolutely true. God cancels. And if you collect the loan beyond the period of 7 years, you are actually taking something that does not belong to you, because God has canceled it. Now, in our laws, some of you realize that we have this to some extent. We have bankruptcy laws where people can file bankruptcy, unable to pay, and they will cancel these loans. In fact, most states, I'm not sure about the state of Arizona, but most states 50 years ago had laws on their books that if loans were unpaid at the end of seven years, there was a statute of limitations and they were uncollectible. Actually had this. Most states, they may still have, and some of them didn't have it as a 7 year cycle. They had it running from 7 years from the time the loan was made. They still had this principle. Now, the reason for that, and this is a vital one, this is so important that its disobedience will destroy a nation just as America is being destroyed. If all loans are canceled every 7 years, if they can't be collected, there is no way you can place mortgages and debts on your children and grandchildren, which we are now doing in America today. I don't believe there are very many people who would go out and make a personal loan, in other words, borrow, say, $10,000 or $5,000 from a banker or a lending institution and say, now, I want to borrow this, but I want you to collect it from my children. And the banker would say, well, okay, you sign this note and commit your children to pay this, and I'll lend you the money. Most people would not do that. But we do it collectively as a nation by allowing our school districts, our municipalities, our state, and our federal government to go borrow money in our name and charge the payment to our children and our grandchildren. And we all do that. Every time we approve a bond issue, every time we allow our government to go further in debt, we are placing debt on our children. And we are forcing them to pay usury and increase to either those who have savings or those who create money. This is a national thing. This is something which affects every person in the nation. Let's read on here. Going down to verse 7. And if there be among you a poor man of one of thy brethren, then any of thy gates in thy land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not harden thine heart or shut thine hand from thy poor brother, but thou shalt open thine hand wide unto him, and shalt surely lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wanteth. At that point then comes the third question. Well, what if it's only 6 months to the cancellation of all debts? What if it's only 30 days? What if I have to cancel this not in 7 years, but 2 weeks from now? John says, beware that there be not a thought in thy wicked heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother, and thou givest him naught, and he cry unto the Lord against thee, and it be a sin unto thee. In other words, don't you stop and think about the possibility it'll be canceled right away before he really has an opportunity to re-earn the money and pay it back. You see, God says we are to take care of the poor at the time they need the help. It has no basis on their ability to pay now or in the future. They're to have it. Most churches in America, 100 years ago, had what they called the poor box. They had a charity committee. They had men who took care of things so that people in the community were given the needs of life if they were poor. There probably isn't one church in 1,000 in America anything like that. Hey. Thou shalt surely give him, and thine heart shall not be grieved when thou givest unto him, because that for this thing the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all thy works, and in all that thou puttest thine hand unto. Isn't that something? Just think about that. God says, if you will lend to the poor or give to the poor when they need it, God will bless you in everything that you do. That's quite a promise. That's a blanket promise that God will benefit you for you having done this thing without thinking of gain, to some extent, without even thinking whether you'll get the money back to him. Verse 11, for the poor shall never cease out of the land, therefore I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thine hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor, and to thy needy in the land. And I repeat again, this is not a command to lend money to people who are not in vital need of the necessities of life. So we're not talking about the lending of money for someone to go into business or to improve their social status or whatever. Go back to verse 4. There's a margin rendering on the first part of that. In the King James it reads, save when there shall be no poor among you. And the margin rendering says, to the end that there shall be no poor among you. Talk about a poverty program. The obedience to the command of God to lend money to the poor that are by thee, and that means in the community, locally. We have organized charity through the government now, so they take your money and they give it to someone 1,000 miles away where you can't even see what's being done with it. And much of that money that's taken from you in taxes for charity is actually stolen by the people who supposedly are helping the poor. So when you don't take care of the people in your own neighborhood and your own community, according to God's command, then the robbers come in and they take more than you would ever lose by helping the poor in your own community. This seems to be, as we read in Ezekiel, of course, an accusation that all of Israel was violating this thing. To the end there shall be no poor among you, for the Lord shall greatly bless thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, only if thou carefully hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all these commandments which I command thee this day. For the Lord thy God blesseth thee, as he promised thee, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, but thou shalt not borrow. Thou shalt reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over thee. And this promise that you will not have to borrow, you Israel nation, as a nation, you will not go into debt if you take care of the poor in the land according to my commandment. Now, whether you believe we're taking care of the poor or not, it's obvious that we're in debt. The entire nation is in debt to at least twice total value of all the land and improvements in the nation. As I pointed out in my revising of the book, Billions for the Bankers, If America turned over the entire nation to the money lenders, that would cancel about half of the debt. We would still owe them another America in order to get out of debt. Now, God told Israel, if you'll take care of the poor in the land, you'll not borrow. But he also told them something else in Deuteronomy 28. Deuteronomy 28 is a chapter where God, through Moses, exhorted Israel to obey the laws for blessing. Then he says in verse 15, but it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. And then he lists a number of them, including verses 43 through 46. The stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. Isn't that something? I don't suppose, and this is a tragedy, I don't suppose there's one church in America in 100 that understands that disobedience to God's laws will put you in money debt. You know, they have a hell that the church will say, oh, if you disobey God's laws, and you sin and you don't go along with the preaching of the church, your punishment is going to be burned in hellfire forever and ever. And they don't tell the people that you will be in debt and you'll be ruled over by aliens in your own land. So you see what happens? We go in debt, the nation is put in debt, the aliens take over the land and rule us and control us, and the church-going people don't understand why it's happening or how it's happening. They don't understand that God said, evidence of your sin is debt and rulership by aliens. I can prove America is in sin and iniquity by pointing out that America is ruled over by aliens, without even pointing out the sin itself. So this is what will happen to you. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail. Moreover, all these curses shall come upon thee, and shall pursue thee, and overtake thee, till thou be destroyed. Because thou hearkenest not unto the voice of the Lord thy God, keep his commandments and his statutes, which he commanded thee. And in case you think those statutes and commandments were put away in Jesus, the next verse says, they shall be upon thee for a sign and for a wonder, and upon thy seed forever. No indication that the judgments for disobedience in these things would be put away. Now, most of the good men in the Congress who are concerned about America think they can alleviate America's problems by balancing the budget. This is the big thing now for all of the conservatives. And in fact, I imagine in the next election that most of the men, or a good share of them, will run for office and ask you for your vote because they want to get in the Congress so they can balance the budget and begin to pay off the national debt. In fact, I'm hearing this more and more from politicians. Balance the budget and pay off the national debt. Well, I'll tell you something. When God Almighty has decreed that you're going to be in debt because of your sin and iniquity, no one is going to balance the budget and pay off the national debt. I don't care what kind of laws they pass. We're in debt because God has decreed we will be in debt. Whatever financial shenanigans they do in Washington, D.C. to put us in debt are allowed by God Almighty to do so because it's written in His Word. I'm convinced, as I said earlier, that the greatest sin in America is our allegiance to a debt usury system because we as individuals want usury and gain from our money. How many American families, if we had a plebiscite today, and on this ballot was a vote saying, yes, we want to end all interest on money in America today. No, we want to continue the present system of interest. How many people do you think would vote to continue interest? I would say practically all of them. practically all of it. There must be thousands of families in America, especially husbands and wives of 50 years old and up, who have money in savings and loans, in U.S. bonds, in some sort of securities, where they are drawing interest. And they would fight you if you tried to tell them they shouldn't draw interest on that money. And they're probably drawing interest on $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 or maybe even $10,000 or $20,000. And not even realizing that they may have 2 to 4 children who are paying interest on $50,000 to $250,000 at the same time they're drawing a few paltry dollars on $1,000. Interest, usury on money is destroying America, and yet I believe the vast majority of the American people, if it were given to them to vote, would vote for interest on money. I would believe that 99% of the church-going people would, because their ministers tell them the laws are put away anyway. And besides, how would the church build that $500,000 building if it couldn't borrow money from its congregation and pay them interest? Almost every large church in America cost over $1,000,000 is paying someone interest on money that they borrowed to build that church. I get several religious publications, and almost every month there are ads in the want ad sections or in display ads in these Christian publications offering 8%, 9%, and 10% on your money if you will lend it in the purchase of church bonds so somebody somewhere can build a building. This thing permeates our society to the extent that I believe it was God's purpose to add this in Ezekiel 22 as the last sin and charge every individual in the nation with committing. I'll turn back to Ezekiel, and let's read that, and then I want to give you a demonstration here. In a minute or so, Ezekiel 22, he says, "Thou hast taken usury and increase, and thou hast greedily gained of thy neighbors by extortion." Now think of the command itself. Individuals in need, your neighbors, the people in your community who need something, you are commanded not only to give it to them, you're commanded to lend it to them without interest, and you're commanded that if they can't pay it back, you forget it, cancel it, let it go. Well, instead, we have proliferating all over America these publications called financial newsletters. Some of you know about them. I subscribe to one primarily so I can see what's going on in the minds of these people. This is Howard Ruff, called The Ruff Times. How many of you know about it? Well, I see quite a few of you do. It's advertised as the fastest growing newsletter on finances, economics, and current conditions in America today. Well, the issue that I just got today has a library of books which he recommends all of you people should buy. Now, mind you, people who subscribe to this are those who know something about the current precarious situation in America. They're afraid of economic collapse, food shortages, strikes, possibly even revolution, even war, outside attacks by foreign countries, and so on. So here are the books that you're supposed to read that will help you do what you should do in this time of near calamity. Let me read some of the titles here and make some comments. Here's one, How You Can Profit from the Coming Price Control. How to Become Financially Independent in Real Estate. Common Sense Economics, and then the subtitle, Your Money, What It Is, and How to Keep It. Number 4, Safe Places East of the Mississippi, whole book. Here's another one, Field Guide to Edible Wild Plants. Now think, they're talking about the possibility of situations so grave and so terrible that you may have to live off the land. That's only one book. The other 25 are telling you how to make money. While you're living out there eating grass? I don't know. Number 7, How to Make Profits in Commodities. Number 8, Kinsman's Guide to Tax Havens. In other words, how to keep from paying taxes. Here's one, The Crash of 79. prophesying economic collapse this year. Here's another one on survival, finding and barring your place in the country. Men, this one is titled The International Man. And this is a book written to tell you how to invest and operate in businesses in other countries so you can make money while America falls apart. The International Man. Here's another one. New Profits from the Monetary Crisis. And then finally, Howard Ruff's book himself, How to Prosper During the Coming Bad Years. Now, I don't know whether you noticed as I read those, but there is a thread that runs all the way through this. What is it? How you personally can survive, and not only survive, but make money while your fellow citizens are starving to death right around you. It is totally based on greed and selfishness. Now, I believe that Howard Ruff is an honest man, and he's concerned for the nation, but there are 28 books in this list, all costing all the way from $1.95 up to about $12.95 a piece. This is being touted, or these are being touted, to the people in America who know most about our bad situation. Not one of them even suggests that the way out of our problems is to get back to God. Not a one. Not only that, they're telling these people how you can make money while everyone else is losing their life savings. What is wrong? There has to be a great change in the spiritual nature of the American people. We are so steeped in sin and greed in this land that we cannot even see what we are doing wrong. These mostly are what we would call good people. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to save themselves while the rest of the nation goes to Hades or wherever you think it might be going. Now, I want to make one quick comment on something else here that was in this morning's paper, and you should read this. Front page of this morning's paper. Now, I prepared this sermon before I read this, but quite often they supply me with something I need to prove a point. Security swindles beat land fraud as top con game. And there's another article, Skepticism Urged Against Get-Rich-Fast Con Pitches. Listen to this. Con men who specialize in peddling phony securities have built their business into Arizona's biggest swindle operation, surpassing even land fraud. And it tells about where this information is coming from in the state attorney general's office. He said swindles involving securities have been increasing the past 2 years. About 75% of the cases under investigation by his division now involve some type of security fraud. The swindlers have bilked millions from their victims, many of them retired persons who were influenced by promises of security and high interest, McDonald said. How are they robbing these people? By appealing to their desire to rob someone else. Because God says usury is theft and robbery. So they come to these people and they say, look, I'll show you how you can rob somebody else and get 12, 15% interest on your money. And millions of American people are falling for it, and then they are being what? They are robbed. I think sometimes that some of these things our divine justice. God says, all right, you won't obey my law. I'm going to let the disobedience of my law itself destroy you and bring you low. Now, I'm out of time for today, and I've hardly touched religion's place in this thing. We'll conclude this next week, God willing.